Okay. Hello, my name is Tamani Brown. I'm a junior at Dartmouth College, calling in from Dartmouth College's campus in Hanover, New Hampshire, and I'm with Joan Marable right now.
Oh,
So,
should
sorry.
I say? Okay, that's
Yeah, you can
okay.
go. Sorry.
We'll get it together.
Yeah.
I'm Joan Marable. I am class of 76 at Dartmouth, well, from Dartmouth, and I'm speaking from Brooklyn, New York, my home in Brooklyn.
Got it.
Okay.
So we're going to start a little bit with your life before Dartmouth. So can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Okay, I was born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts. Where I grew up. So, yeah, I lived in Dorchester, which is back then it was the part of Dorchester and Roxbury were the black communities in Boston, and so that's where I grew up.
So, I'm not very familiar with Boston, but you said that Dorchester was one of the black communities. Outside of Boston, was there not a lot of, were there not a lot of other black people around?
It was just a major concentration. And when you said you lived in Dorchester or Roxbury, especially Roxbury, which is right next, well, the boundaries were blurred. The assumption was that you were black
Got it.
back in those
And
days.
yeah. And actually, Roxbury does sound kind of familiar. I might be off, but I think New Edition is from there, like the R&B group.
They might be. They were a little bit after my time, but I think so. Yeah. Yeah, I think
Okay.
so. Yeah.
Okay. So I think I know what you're talking about. Okay. So can you tell me a little bit about what your high school was like?
Well, I went to Beaver Country Day School in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, which was a girls' prep school. I started actually in the seventh grade there. In 1966, and at that time we were sort of an experiment. My parents decided that there was no option. They were not going to send me to be bused to the suburbs outside of Roxbury and Dorchester because, unfortunately, at that time, well, that was during the height of the civil rights movement, King was. And everybody else, things were going on. Let's just put it that way to make it shorter. But the kids who were bused, oftentimes the buses were stoned and attacked, and the kids had time with that at their school. So as a result, my parents had heard that the school was accepting black girls, and it was an all-girl school. So I was one of four girls, black girls in my class, and about I think there were six in the whole school. So I went all the way through seventh grade, 7 through 12. I graduated from there and went on to Dartmouth, but it was definitely a predominantly white institution, very similar to how prep schools are now. And but we were the experiment.
That's really interesting. So, I guess kind of following with the experiment idea, as you progressed through like seventh, eighth, so on until like your senior year, did you start to see like, I guess, a higher concentration of black students at your high school?
Numbers went up, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say it's concentration. I think we were the second class. The other two girls were the class before me. So they might have added one or two black girls per grade after that. By the time I was getting ready to graduate, they were talking about making it a co-ed school. So by that time, there might have been probably a few more kids per grade, but it was a small school, but still the numbers were teeny.
Yeah,
So, yeah.
I can imagine. So I guess in your college application process, did you consider any other schools or was it just Dartmouth all the way?
Well, I don't know if you know, but my class is part of the first is the first class of women who were invited to matriculate as first year students. So I before that decision was made, because that decision came out like right in the middle of college app time our senior year. So I had applied early decision to Bowdoin and they had deferred me. And then like a week later, I heard that Dartmouth was looking for women to apply. In fact, they sent re representatives to the school saying we would like some women from the school to apply, or they called us girls, of course. So I think six of us applied. Two of us got in. Two out of the four black girls in my class. We were the only two who got in, and both of us came to Dartmouth. So I had also been accepted by then, regular decision to Bowdoin. So in my mind, I was saying, well, I have a choice. My parents said, absolutely not. You're going to an Ivy League college. There's nobody in our family who's ever been any Ivy anything. Are you kidding? So I mean, I didn't not want to go, but those were how decisions were made back then. Parents had
Got
a
it.
major influence.
I definitely get it. But out of curiosity, if you, I guess, did really have that choice, would you have still picked Dartmouth or would you go with Bowdoin?
I probably would have picked Dartmouth. That's an interesting question. I never thought of it that way because I just put it out of my mind. I knew I'm going to Dartmouth. It was like, but I think the pros outweigh the cons. I mean, both had gorgeous campuses. I mean, Bowdoin's in Maine. You think it was cold in Hanover? Huh.
Yeah, I've heard about Maine.
Bowdoin not only is the same kind of cold, but it's also on the off the water, so it's really cold. It's but I'm a New Englander, so I went to camp every summer in Maine, and then became a camp counselor. So I like Maine, but I think Dartmouth ended up being a better choice for me, definitely. I mean, things that developed in my life since going to Dartmouth. I don't know if that would have happened if I was at Bowdoin. Who knows?
Right. So when you first arrived to Dartmouth, what did you think of the campus or the school as a whole? Like, what was your perception of it?
Well, when I got there, first of all, I said, wow, this looks like your consummate college campus, a green, old buildings,
Yeah.
everything else. I mean, Dartmouth back then did not look anything like it does now. I mean, there's so many buildings now. I mean, we had a long way to walk between dorms and classes, and oh, it was a long way. My bike was my friend until I couldn't use it like on the ice or something, but I biked everywhere because that was the only way I could get to class on time. And the campus was nice. I don't think we had visited beforehand. I don't remember. We could have. My father liked to drive everywhere, all over the place in New England, northern New England. So we could have visited beforehand, but for some reason, I don't think we did. But are you talking about the physical impression or just in general, like people or what?
I think in general, yeah.
Okay. All right. So I noticed there were not a lot of people who looked like me, but coming from a predominantly white institution, I said, okay, so this is more of the same with that. I was sort of used to that. So it didn't bother me that much. But I know for a fact that I was always looking and say, hi, my name is, what class are you? Or, are you a faculty member or a, family member or whoever? And just in general, also because it was the beginning of co-education, there were signs in different places, discreet or otherwise, that women were not welcome as fellow students. So, I sort of figured that out, and I think we all did as women, sort of figured that out and just said, am I going to let this bother me? No, because I am decided I'm going to be here. So,
So when you did get here, what did you major in and how did you decide on that?
well, I started out as a bio major because I was going to do the pre-med route. I said that to my parents, and that was the thing to do. And I was a bio major and pre-med until I finished organic chemistry, and I have a story about that, so we'll get to that in a second. And then I changed my major to psychology, and I never declared a minor or a double major. I could have probably with religion because I took a lot of religion classes as well. Not that I am necessarily a religious person, but just studying religion, especially the Judeo-Christian tradition, it was just really interesting to me to understand history and try to find the truth about that, because I knew that there was too much division in that, and that always bothered me. Even though I grew up in the church, I didn't understand why, like if we're all Christians, why are we all in different directions and vehemently disagree with one another about that? Or if you're Jewish, why is that so bad? Or if you're Muslim, why is that so bad? Because that's also part of that tradition too. And so that's why. But long story short, I went from being a bio major to a psychology major.
Got it. And so a lot of people say, when they were on that pre-med track, it's always organic chemistry that stops them. So can you tell me about your story with that?
Well, mine was a little different, I think. I don't think that it continued the same way after what happened to me and the other women in my class. So, first of all, I don't know why, but I took organic spring term of my freshman year, which is the stupidest thing in the world, but nobody told me that it was. So that in itself, I did very well in the sciences going up to organic chemistry. So I was in the class, and there were probably about four or five other women. I think I was the only Black woman for that term in the class. And the teaching assistant stood up in front of the class. He was in charge of labs, and he announced that every woman in his class, in this class, will not pass any of his labs. He will make sure of that because, and we're looking at him like, what is he talking about? And basically, he said, I applied to med school. I know you all are thinking about going to med school. And since I couldn't get in, you're not going to get in, and you need organic to pass to get in. So I'll make sure of it. So we're like, oh yeah, he's just talking. Well, no, he wasn't. So what he would do, he sabotaged our labs. In organic, your labs are supposed to be completely dry, And he would come around after we said that we're finished and the lab is completely dry, and we knew that it was. And he'd look at it, he said, "Oh, let me come closer." And of course, everything, the labs were really close. So, and they were close to each station had a sink. So he'd turn on the water real hard, blast the water, splash the lab results, and of course, they'd get wet. And he said, "Oh, gee, I'm sorry, but your lab is not dry. I guess you failed this lab." So he kept doing this. So we, not knowing that each of us had this same situation, at least immediately, we started going to the dean. There was a Black woman dean, Joan Nelson. She was a dean who happened to be a Black woman. She was like my mom on campus. And I went to her, you know, I can speak from the I perspective, and I told her what was happening. And evidently, other women went to her as well. And he got himself fired. So, and then meanwhile, my grade for organic was kind of sketchy. So I was really freaking out. For my final, and long story short, my mom and Dean Nelson said, "Just take the exam, just finish it." I aced the exam. It shocked me because they told me that they basically gave me permission to relax, and I aced it. But after that, I said, "Well, maybe I don't want to do this." So that's a horrible way to come to a decision, but that's sort of had a big influence on that. And I said, "Do I really want to go through this?" No. So I don't know. Maybe I was a scaredy cat, or maybe just, you know, I don't know why. It just, after that, it just, I changed my mind.
I think it's really understandable why. I mean, it's just, I wouldn't say you should expect it from other students, but I guess it's easier to expect it from other students than it is to expect from a professor. So I think I absolutely understand. And I'm very sorry that happened. It's kind of ridiculous. I don't know. It's.
Thought nothing would happen. I mean, we didn't know anything was going to happen, but it sure didn't sit well. You know, it's like it, and I wasn't one who was like woman, women, women, yeah, rah, rah, rah. I was more about Black folk, but still, I just said, this isn't right. You know, I deserve every right, every opportunity that these other people do. Why is he doing this? You know, and he was messing with me, you know, my mind and everything else. I didn't like that, so.
Was that, I guess, an isolated incident, or has that ever happened to you again during your time at Dartmouth?
Not from a professor, just random stupid comments, usually from other students, male students in the class who were there. They didn't want us to, if we answered or tried to answer a question, they groan or something like that. And then 30 seconds later, they give the same answer. And when you're going through stuff like that, you don't realize how idiotic that is. You just get annoyed. But you know, I can laugh about it now, but you know, and we didn't have terminology like microaggressions and all that other stuff back then. But it was just all that stuff was going on.
So I want to come back to the whole co-education thing for a second, but before we do, what activities were you involved in on campus?
I was involved with the AM as much as I could be studying. I spent most of my time studying, making sure that I could finish and graduate and maintain a halfway decent GPA. And then I worked. I was part of a work study program. First, I started out in the dining hall. Their dining hall is not called that anymore. Was it Night Class in 52 Dining
53
Hall?
Commons. Yeah.
And I worked the steam tables, and that's how my husband, well, dated me half the time. Football team. He was part of the football team, and they ate separate from everybody else. So he would come through the line, get his food, you know, because I'm part of the line serving the food. Then he'd stand there and talk to me. Then he'd go to the table and dump his food on the tray from the plate and come back with his plate and repeat this. So he had a mountain of food and then he ate
So, and your husband, oh, sorry,
he's, yeah,
go
his
ahead.
class is 74, Ken Marable. So, and
And
then, go ahead.
oh, I was gonna ask, is that how you guys met? Because I know he was also a Dartmouth student, and is that how you met?
We actually met in the bookstore. Let me finish about the work. The
Yeah.
work, that was the question, right? What I forgot what you said. How did I spend my time?
Like activities in general, and
Yeah,
work was part of that. Yeah.
okay. Because I could go all over the place. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
But and then I'm talking about work experience, and then I got tired of that. So then I sewed. I used to make almost all of my clothes. So the theater department needed somebody, a costume assistant, somebody who could help sew the costumes and help halfway design them. So I did that. That was my job. That when I was working on campus, that's pretty much what I did until I didn't have to work anymore, which I don't remember. That could have been the whole time. I don't even remember. That's a long time ago. But yeah, I remember those because those were long hours. I mean, I liked being creative. I liked theater. I liked the arts, but you know, I wasn't on the performing end for that, as far as being on the stage, except for dance. And there was no formal dance anything at Dartmouth, but dance companies would come, and myself and some spouses, faculty spouses, wives would dance, you know, take master classes. One faculty spouse in particular, Mrs. Hill. I don't know if you've ever met her, Professor Hill's wife. Her first name is escaping me, which is terrible. But she's still up in Hanover, by the way. She's in a senior home up there, right outside, right in Hanover, actually. But yeah, and then like my junior year, they created the opportunity for us to perform on campus. Those of us who wanted to, we were part of the Dartmouth Players. So, you know, I was in a couple of dance concerts. So, and then as I did stuff with the AM parties. Yeah. I like the parties. And because I never had a chance when I was in high school, my parents were very particular and protective on that.
Thank you.
And then every once in a while, we as Black women on camp, a few of us got together and would cook some food and eat. But you know, it's mostly studying. Then
Yeah.
I go and watch football games and stuff like that, you know, the usual stuff. So getting back to how I met Ken, my husband, class of 74, he was up part of the football team, and they come up, I guess they start practice, what, 2 or 3 weeks before the semester, the term starts or whatever it is. And freshman week, we got our assignments for our classes and all this other stuff. So I was in the bookstore, and all the freshmen back in the day, the textbooks and all that were in the basement of the bookstore. And all the freshmen were down there, and there was this huge line snaking up the stairs to the cash registers. So I don't know if you've ever felt somebody staring at you from the
Yes.
back. I turn around, here's this dude with blue granny glasses and overalls and a red flannel shirt and black high top sneakers. And here I am, Miss Prep School in my crew neck sweater and corduroys and petty loafers. And I'm looking at him. So he said, "I know a line. I know a way you don't have to stand in the line." I said, "Okay, let me get my friend, the other girl who came to Dartmouth the same time I did, the other black girl." He said, "Forget about her, naive me." I left her. She was so mad. Said afterwards, she said, "How do you like this guy? He's not even your type." Well, I was just like, "He's nice. I don't So after football practice, he'd said that, "Let's go and get something to eat." He had a car, which was highly unusual back then. So we went to, I forgot what town. There was McDonald's was new then, believe it or not. That's a long time, 50 years ago. So we went to McDonald's and I watched him eat more food. I've never seen anybody eat as much food as he had in this short amount of time and be
Football
like
player
this.
appetite.
Yeah, I've never seen that before. And and then we went for ice cream, and after that, and he shut his hand in the door. He's probably gonna kill me if I sold this whole So he's sniffing back tears. And I said, "If this guy is okay with this, he's okay." He was trying very hard to show his gentlemanly side. He always was and still is a gentleman, and that I think is what attracted me to him. So I mean, really, we met my freshman week, freshman fall term week, and we were sort of pretty much together the whole time. So that's how I met him. Nice
Wow.
guy.
He sounds very nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We get on
Okay.
each other's nerves every once in a while, but that can be expected.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing. My next question is, what was the relationship like between, I guess, the women of your class being that first class to bring in co-education?
Within the ranks of the women,
Yes.
that was interesting because we came from all kinds of backgrounds. The ratio male to female was 10 to 1. The ratio of, well, let's put it this way. There were 27 black women on campus. My fall term freshman year. And that included black women. I think there were five or seven, I forget, something like that, less than 10. Black women ranging from the class of 73 to through 75. They came to Dartmouth. They were there originally as transfer students, no, exchange students. And then when Dartmouth did full co-education, they applied and the college accepted them as transfer students. So they were able to graduate from with a degree from Dartmouth. So we were close, as individual personalities go, closer to some people more than others. I had a few girls on my floor. I was the only black girl on my floor. I was in Butterfield pretty much the whole time I was at Dartmouth, and I never had a roommate. Which was great. I loved it with a single. In fact, except for my freshman year, I had a single with a half bath. So that was really good. But the one of the women on my floor was the President Kemeny's daughter. So the president of the college's daughter was on my floor. We sort of see each other at reunions and stuff like that. So I don't say that we're super duper close friends, but we are still, when we see each other at reunions, we say hi and, friendly enough. And black women, depending on who it is, I mean, even though we didn't have a whole lot, we sort of know all of us know each other. And we connect more so with BADA stuff, Black Alumni of Dartmouth stuff.
Right.
But the cooking, that was definitely, there were about four or five of us who were cook. Out of everybody, I was least talented. I thought I was the thing until I came up to Dartmouth and I realized I know nothing. I was in charge of the deviled eggs and things like tuna fish and stuff like that.
So they
They
just
were
gave you the
frying the
cans.
chicken and making stuff. I was like, I didn't do that right. They let me know that really fast. So I was like, oh, okay. But it was fun. We had a good time. Three of my classmates, black women, were in my wedding. And yeah, we lost one of them. My maid of honor, she died. Oh boy, let's see. I have to do the math. Our youngest is 36. And her, she had a child around the same time, and she died less than a year later than that, after that. So yeah, she's been gone about 35 years. But yeah, that, long story short, we that was sort of our relationship, my relationship with them. We were sisters. We had each other's back. We made sure that we were on point. If somebody was doing something stupid, we let them know nicely. Some people not so nicely, but still, because we were a small group. There were 27 of us, and we knew what was happening, and the black community was small enough. Everybody knew what everybody was doing. So. You couldn't sneak too much.
So I guess kind of branching out to the black community as a whole, what were the interactions like between black men and black women on campus at the time?
Again, it depends on who it I had, again, coming from a very protective background, I was not used to the first 3 weeks of freshman fall term Every 15 minutes, a brother would come by and knock on my door. Hi, my name is so and so. I'd like to get to know you better. And I figured out after a while what that meant. And it's like, no. And back in those days, if you were a good girl, you had your door open if a guy was in your room. So, like, even Ken, who I was dating at the time, you know, when he was there, my door was wide open. So the last time that these dudes decided to d do this 15-minute trip, he was sitting in my room helping me with a paper because I was trying to figure out what are they looking for. And I guess word went out. You can't go by Joan's house, room anymore because Ken is there. Because I got mad. I left Ken there with the guys. So they came and they're like, wait a minute, what are you doing here? So other brothers were really nice also. When I went through that thing with organic, there were some upperclassmen who were already, you know, fast tracked towards med school. So they gave me enough confidence to keep going because I didn't know what was happening with that class, you know, between the TA and then just the pressure itself. Taking it during my freshman year. And of course, they didn't even say, why are you doing this freshman year? I think by the end, they said after the fact, we couldn't understand why you did that. But anyhow, I don't know to this day. I try to get it over with. I have no idea. But anyhow, and then, you know, I would say that's about it, you know, as far as with the black men. We got along. I mean, I didn't see black men on campuses as somebody who was there to hurt me because we had enough of that going on with other folks. And we were so small as far as a community, even if we were not necessarily friends per se, we knew that we had the same goal, and that was to finish, to do well enough to graduate and graduate on time and look out for each other. And so I would say that that was the relationship. Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay.
My next question is, what was the engagement like between Black students and Black faculty?
There was very few black faculty.
Mm.
Professor Errol Hill, again, I spoke of his wife. He was the only, I think, the only black tenured professor at that time. I don't know if he was chair of the theater department then, but I think he did become that, did have that position assigned to him before I graduated. So he was all about, you know, he was a Caribbean brother. Their family is Bajan, and they were all about, you know, we black people, we need to be proud of what we do. And, you know, based on the types of theater that he had students participate in and just the influence he had on who came up to the hop, I think that a lot of stuff, you know, we were all trying to make things work, you know, the Afro-Am was, you know, really blooming then. It was the only place that we had, really. There was no other thing for foreign students. And I mean, if you were a foreign student and you were black, you still came to the Am. If you were an exchange student, you came to the Am. If you were any part of anywhere on the LGBTQ plus spectrum. You came to the end. We all, that was our place. So, and there was another, there were some other families there as well. I mentioned Jean, Joan Nelson, Dean Joan Nelson. She was like a mother to me and to all of, pretty much all of the Black women on campus. You know, she understood what we were going through as a Black woman. And she would calm us and direct us and tell us also if we were going off the deep end. But again, nobody told me about her again. But I don't understand. But that was maybe they told me and I just didn't hear. I don't think so. But and her husband, Berkey Nelson, I forgot what he taught, but he was a professor there. And there weren't too many. There was an English professor, a Black woman. I can't remember her name. Professor Cook was there. I never, you know, it was interesting. I never had a Black professor. And all the time I was in
Really?
Congress, never had one. And, you know, I thought about that in retrospect. In my lifetime, I never had a Black professor, teacher, nothing. That's sad, but you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. But that never happened, and you know, I lost on that. But yeah, there were not many. I mean, Dartmouth has not a whole lot, but it's a whole lot more than what we had back then in the early 70s, early to mid 70s. And even when our children were there, in the early aughts, the early 2000s, there were more faculty members of color, Black and otherwise. So yeah, but not when I was there.
That's really interesting. I think, like you said, there's not really a lot now either, but there is like a big improvement. But it's also interesting to hear that you said you've never had one because I think that's still pretty common now. Like a lot of students have never had a Black professor, at least not at Dartmouth. Yeah. Like, I think they're around a lot, and I've had classes that were taught by Black professors, but I do know it's like pretty common to like not have that experience. So it's just really interesting to hear you say that. Yeah, so my next question is a little bit different, kind of more related to the AM in a sense and activities on in general. Was there any, I guess, strong involvement? I know Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity was on campus at this time. Was there any, like, I guess, involvement that they had with the entire community that you remember that you were part of?
Alpha Phi Alpha, the first line, why do I want to say it was 19, that I remember was 1974? I think it was 1974. My husband was online for 30 seconds. No. Not very long. And he said, I'm not going through this my senior year. Are you kidding me? No, I don't need to do this now. If I was like a sophomore, maybe my senior year, no. And I don't know. I didn't mention, but I finished the Dartmouth, the D plan. It was called the D plan back then, was a 3 to 5 year plan. So you could finish your studies between 3 and 5 years, and I finished in 3 years in a term. So I was not there during my class's senior year. I had already finished my credits. So As far as influence, I'm sure there was a lot of influence by then. My senior year, it was starting to, they were starting to have some influence my junior year while I was there, but I don't remember that much as far as them, like if you're asking if they almost like ran the AM, I don't think so. I think they have more influence now than they did back then, as far as what I understand. And also when my children, our children were there, they had a lot of influence. Black fraternities and sororities were there by then. But when I was there, no.
Got it. And you said you finished in 3 years and a term. What made you decide to do that instead of, I guess, staying the whole 4 years?
First of all, I tell everybody, do not do that.
Yeah,
You need to be there the whole 4 years because senior year is a different experience, and I never got to experience. Part of it was naivety, and I didn't say this to anybody until many, many years afterwards. But I thought since my husband had graduated in 74, and back then you didn't shack up with anybody, my parents would not allow that. I figured, well, my parents, we got engaged after he graduated in 74, and I still would have had 2 more years. And my parents said, you're not getting married until you finish at Dartmouth. So I said, okay. So I finished. And I said, your parents said this, and you, I was Miss Goody Two Shoes. I said, okay, I'll do that. I don't think they thought I would do it that fast, but I finished in 3 years of term. Actually, I know there's several people who did that for different reasons. Some people did it because they couldn't stand it on campus. Mine wasn't for that reason, or the finances, they couldn't, the faster they got it, the less they had to pay. But mine was plain and simple. I thought he would disappear. So I said, well, if I'm gonna continue with this process, I need to finish and finish a year early. So I did. I finished August of 75, and we got married in November of 75, and we came back so I could walk with my class in May of 76. But as a result, I did not do study abroad. Big mistake. I did not experience any of the senior things that people do as seniors that I have found out over the years. And, made sure that our kids, when they went to Dartmouth, I said, do not do what mama did. Please do not. You do the whole go abroad and do your senior year. So they did.
Okay. Well, that's great to hear. So, I guess, well, it's kind of, I guess, a natural, this naturally just kind of aligns with my questions because now I'm kind of like moving into, I guess, the post-Dartmouth route. So, what did you do after your graduation and after your marriage, I guess?
Well, I worked for a number of years in property casualty insurance, basically medical malpractice insurance, which even though I had not attended med school, I just still had an intense interest in medicine. So I found out things that doctors and hospitals shouldn't do, even though I had to support them even in their liabilities, which was very stressful. I did property casualty for a while, and then I did I was with the Board of Education or the Department of Education, as it's called now, in the city of New York with the Chancellor's office for a while. And then after we were married for 8 years, we started having children, and I was home with them for a while, but I would go back periodically to work with the Board of Education and did a lot of volunteer work. And then 24 years ago, I started a nonprofit for high school kids.
Right. And that is the Diversity Awareness Initiative for students.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And I noticed that your husband Ken is also part of it. I think he's the president of the board.
Yeah.
Did you guys start it together, like as a joint thing?
Well, it's interesting because our daughter Kimberly, when she was in the 10th grade, had been part of another organization that was very similar to it, and it just stopped existing. And she and three of her friends came to me literally in tears, saying, "We want to do something similar to this. We want an organization where we as students have a voice, but a little more of a voice than we did before. Can you help us?" And I said, "Okay." So here I am, still 24 years later, still doing this. But I forgot what your question was.
That's fine. That's fine. My question was basically just, did you and Ken start it together
Oh
or?
yes, yeah. So we had to have a board, so he became president of the board. He helped me at the beginning, and then we had to have a board. So we tried to. It's interesting. Some people say you shouldn't have a board where you play it so close to the chest, but because of how we created the organization and the fact that most of the students who participate are we're open to everybody, kids from independent, parochial, and public schools, but most of the kids come from independent schools because most people feel that kids who go to independent schools because they have these fabulous educational opportunities that they don't have any issues with identity or how to deal with things, and that is totally wrong. Totally. And as a result, because I am not a trained teacher, I had a lot of faculty members from the different schools when we first started, and some major organizations come to me and tell me to cease and desist because I was not a quote unquote educator. And I said, no, there's nothing like that exists for these kids and they need the support. Of course, everybody loves us now. But so, long story short, in order to make sure that we continue to exist, we sort of kept everything close knit. We have other board members too, but they sort of feel the same way we do. Their kids went to independent schools. All of our children are have been adults for a while, and we just felt that there was a need for our kids to and everybody's kids to be able to have this voice, to have the agency, to be able to have these safe discussions about social justice issues and all of the language about all of the things that we went through over 50 years ago and you still go through now at any institution, but specifically PWIs. It's needed. It still needs to be addressed. And the only way I feel that we can make a change is to make sure that young people, and I'm talking about kids, children, teens, learn how to develop the language to have these discussions. That's how you have a leadership. I'm part of a generation where we were to be seen and not be heard. I resented that. And when we were raising our children, we definitely, because my husband had the same situation, and we said we are not going to do that for our children. We want to hear what they have to say. And so we also do that with this organization. And I would say that we've impacted over 10,000 kids doing that. A lot of them have come to Dartmouth. I don't always know that they're there until I come on campus and somebody's yelling my name across the green. This is terrible. But we encourage these kids to do that because not everybody has the same opportunities to have discussions or to voice their opinion either at home or at school. Definitely not at school. Or at home, depends on the environment or in the community. So, this whole thing that you see student movement now, that's nothing new. It's just that it's become, I don't know, I guess more publicized. But, I know we've been doing this for 24 years now. This is the 24th year of having kids do that because it's necessary. You can't. I did not have a voice, as I said, and I didn't know that I could have a voice till well into my adulthood. That's ridiculous. So I think as a result of self-reflection and realizing what I didn't know and what I didn't have, and the fact that our daughter and then her friends came with this request, it was seemed like an opportunity that we had to take up. So that's sort of how we keep doing. And the schools like what we do. I mean, this whole Black Ed thing that we were having discussions about that without the hashtag and all that for years. The schools don't know that, but we were, but we, because the kids, and this is basically for the tri-state area, the greater New York City area, and Connecticut and New Jersey, the kids realized that they could have these discussions and develop the strength in their opinion and their voice, and then go on and express themselves on campus and maybe make a change on campus and then beyond that in their adulthood. Our oldest alums are in their low 40s already. It seems crazy, but that's what happens. So I don't know if I answered your question.
You absolutely did. Thank
Okay.
you. And that I'm not a private school product, but I do absolutely understand the need for all of this. So I just want to thank you for being able to, I guess, give these students the chance to do what you felt like you weren't able to, because I think it's just very important to, like you said, reflect on what I guess previous generations wanted to do or weren't able to, and allowing like the current and next generations to do. So I think that's just very admirable. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. We have kids from public school and parochial school too, but the majority, vast majority is independent school. I mean, I don't turn anybody away. We even have homeschool kids now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I have one more question about this. So you mentioned that it's in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Could you see it branching out, I guess, beyond that to other cities around the country?
I would love to. I don't have the bandwidth because it's just me, pretty much. I know my husband has always said we should do it nationwide. I can't do it nationwide. I know what it takes to do it effectively in this area.
Right.
It's something that's needed. I know that some of our alums have set up things that sort of take little bits and pieces of what they experienced through Dais and created something wherever they were. But then they realize how much work it takes. So they usually
Right.
it usually doesn't last. But you know, and I know that there are actual companies that have tried to implement parts of or things that are similar to ours. But usually, again, it's a group of educators. And you know, my mom's was a retired was an educator. She retired as an educator. She's no longer with us. But I just know that educators, their job, or at least they feel that their job is to make sure that they lead kids and basically tell them almost how to say things or what to say. And we don't do that. We're a peer facilitated group, and that's what makes a difference, I think, between a lot of these companies. I mean, they're literally companies that charge a whole lot of money for what we do and don't charge the kids anything. The only thing we charge for pretty much is our annual conference, and that's low budget compared to some of these other things. So it's interesting to see how all of this pans out. But na nationally, it would be nice. I don't know. I think if I was 20 years younger, maybe I could think of doing that now. But I don't think I have the bandwidth or the energy at this point to have it. And that's a sad thing. Right now, I mean, the goal was by year 25 to have somebody or a couple of people in place to take over, and COVID sort of put a pause in that. So I know I'm going to be doing this re-energizing the organization post-COVID. Probably it'll take another 2 years or so to do that. I mean, like everything else, Zoom, everybody zoomed out. Zoom has
Yeah.
been our friend for almost 3 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
Right. So I only have a couple more questions. One of them is, are you involved in BATA now?
Yes. I go to BATA events. My husband has been in I don't remember what it's called, the title, regional director or something for BATA off and on, probably for the past 30 years. And basically, and for New York City, pretty much. And I help him with organize a lot of events. We do things together here. Sometimes it's just making sure we all get up on campus, which is a tough thing. Some people don't want to go back because of
Right.
their experience. I mean, Ken and I go back. We didn't, our experience was not a bunch of roses, and our children, our daughter's class of 05 and her son is 08. And our daughter, you know, she was a theater major. She's a professional actor. She's been on Broadway and stuff like that. And our son is an urban planner. And our daughter said, I don't want to go to college outside of the city. And then she came up to Dartmouth on her own without us and fell in love and applied early decision and got in. Our son, on the other hand, said, I always wanted to go to Dartmouth, and then had us run around to 25 schools. It still applied early decision and gun. And it wasn't a legacy thing, even though I must say, Kimberly was the second Black double legacy to come to Dartmouth. The first one was a woman classmate of mine and a guy who she married in class of 75. Their son came to Dartmouth. He's class of 01. But yeah, we've been a lot of green up there. My brother was a class of 79, and my parents, again, they had the last say, so they made him come. He did not like Dartmouth, but he graduated. He graduated. He did okay. He did quite well, actually. But if he had his druthers, he would not have been in Dartmouth.
Got it. Okay, so my last question for you is, how has your perception of Dartmouth changed since you were a student?
A lot of things have changed, and a lot of things are definitely still the same. So I think the opportunities, first of all, to get in, I probably would not be able to get into Dartmouth. When our children got in, I don't think I would have been able. I was a good student in high school, but the test scores and all the stuff that was required then, I mean, as I said, they were early 2000s, and even the requirements then were way above what was required back in the early 70s. And just watching the difference between our daughter's experience and our son's experience, they overlap 1 year, her senior year and his freshman year. Their experiences were very different because of their personalities, but also what was on campus. I mean, as well, in the early 2000s, the faculty support, the hiring and retention of faculty and staff of color was still pretty bad. It still is, but it was really bad still. Back then, it's improved some, and the whole situation with assault and sexual assault and on one hand, I say it's the same as when I was there, except we didn't know how to talk about it. We just knew we felt bad. And it was sort of like, what did I do? Because that was the accepted norm, is that it was always the woman's fault. And now at least students have a voice in saying, no, I didn't do anything. This person did this to me or said this to me, or the microaggressions, the whole aspect of communicating and what is acceptable and what isn't. Again, same stuff going on, but there's more of a language to be able to handle that now, or at least address it. I don't say it's resolved because it doesn't. I read the Dartmouth daily briefs every once in a while. I don't read them every day, but I get the emails, and it was like, gee, this same stuff we went through is just, they got a name to it now. So I think that is good. I'm thrilled, as I said, about the Black faculty who I have met, the new DEI person, the vice president. I forgot her name. The sister, who is it? What is her name? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
You got to meet her if you haven't met her. She's fabulous. So, I can't remember her name, but I met her at the 50th. I was up, we were up for the 50th anniversary of BATA. I'll be up again for the 50th anniversary of coeducation for a day and a half, because our daughter Kimberly is going to be on the panel for people in entertainment from I think it's called Star Power, from Broadway to Hollywood. So, but getting back to your question, I think, and I don't expect it to be any different, because I don't expect a tremendous amount of difference, because environmental stuff, and I'm not talking about green stuff, I'm talking about the social environment on campus. A lot of it has to do with systems, that the how the college was created. I don't know if you know, or if students know on campus, but slavery was a big part of how the college started. I didn't know that when I was a student. I didn't know that probably until about 10 years ago. But that was highly accepted. And for the fact that the college is acknowledging that, that's a good thing. What they'll do about it, I don't know. But you take one change happens one thing and one step at a time. And because a lot of things are based on systems that are in existence, and unless you change the systems, it's really hard to make permanent changes on other things. I mean, coeducation exists because the systems in this country, just having an elite male organization, there are a few left, but it's kind of tough to maintain that. And Dartmouth and a lot of other institutions like Dartmouth have realized the strength and the power of women, and their especially their alumni base, but even the students and faculty member as well. I mean, back when I was there, I mean, with these guys, when we came freshman year, all of our freshman year, and I don't even know, it might have even been part of the early part of our sophomore year, they still busted women from women's colleges for socials. Like, you're here, but it doesn't matter. This is a tradition we have, so we got to bus in our weekend entertainment. It's like, So, that's a system that eventually changed on campus. And that's because I think that it was just not acceptable in enough places in the country, so that they had to make that change. When you're talking about other aspects of social identifiers, like race or ethnicity or even sexual identity or sexual orientation, we still have a long way to go. And I know that Dartmouth is trying to do their thing, and there have been some things that have failed and some that have succeeded a little bit, but until there's a major change in how the system works, it's not going to be a permanent thing. And it's easy enough to just slide on back to how it was. So that's my opinion, but I still appreciate Dartmouth for the experience and the exposure that I had for my education. I was not an A student, but I wasn't at the bottom of the class either, probably in the middle. I don't know if Dartmouth necessarily gave me super duper opportunities, but it didn't hurt. And if anything, between my education in high school in similar type of institution, an elite type thing, and I'm not saying that it comes strictly from that, but I had enough exposure to what other people had to realize that I could have that for me and for my family as well. And that's how I look at my experience at Dartmouth. I don't dislike it. It was not perfect. I don't think any place is. With the society, our country's recognition all of a sudden of HBCUs, I'm wondering if I should have participated in that. What is it, the 10 college exchange with Spelman? They still have that, Spelman, and
Yeah, we do still have that.
I think about that more and more. I said, boy, I think I should have. I wonder what that would have been. No, I think it would have been a really nice experience. Not that I didn't have a cultural connection. My parents made sure that I did, and we in turn have done the same thing with our children. I mean, outside of school, the influence, you knew you had pride in who you were and where you came from. And we still do that. So I think that's important, regardless of what your background is. But we as Black people especially have had so much taken away from us that I just feel it's important that we do that. So, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, if we were to sit down and look at Dartmouth now compared to how it was 50 years ago, as I say, there are a lot of things that have changed and a lot of things that are still the same. And I don't discourage people from attending Dartmouth. I've had, as I said, from Dais, if I know a kid's interested in Dartmouth, I tell them that we were there and don't expect it to be perfect because no place is perfect. But you will have the opportunities that you need. We didn't make our children go to Dartmouth, but they also understood that the opportunities would be there that they needed, and they took advantage of that. I'm thankful for that they were able to have the grades and everything to go. Because as I said, I would not be able to get into Dartmouth when they applied. In no way. But yeah, they did well. So I sort of ramble. I feel like I ramble all over the place, but
It's
I hope that I
welcome.
answered your question.
You absolutely did. Thank you so
Okay.
much. Well, I'm gonna end the recording right now. Thank you so much for talking with me today, though.
Okay.